This is the Lacare Cast. Hello and welcome to the Lacare Cast. My name is Jeff and I'm your host. Each episode, we take a deeper dive into all things Lacare. We're back with episode 2 of this look at various revelations from the recent Book of Letters, A Private Spy. And I am welcoming back Matthew Bradford. Matthew, thanks for coming back to part 2.
Pleasure to be here.
I'm glad I haven't driven you to running for the hills yet with my obsessing over all things Lacare. We're here to talk about the professional end of things. But before we get to that, I have to ask you, what did you think of Tim Cornwell's introduction to this book? Because I thought that might be one of my favorite things of this collection. I thought it was just so well done and really drew you into what we were to read later.
Yeah, I thought so too. It was really fantastic. And it's lengthy too. It's not a short introduction, and I appreciated that. And it really sets the scene for what's to come. And I said before that this was one of my favorite books of letters, and it was particularly readable straight through, whereas I often like to dip in and out of books of letters of authors. But a big part of that is because of the way that Tim sets it. Now, I'm using Tim not because I have any familiarity with him, but because all of his sons are named Cornwell. So it seems like a waste of time to say Tim Cornwell again and again, as opposed to Stephen or, you know, any of the other Cornwells we'd be talking about. But I thought his introduction was really heartfelt and personal, as well as sort of giving an insight into his process and how he became closer to his father after his death by going through his archive, you know, by following these trails that the letters read on. And it's just something that's become so extra poignant because of the fact that Tim then passed away before it came out. And there's a very heartfelt note from the other brothers right after his introduction explaining that and how they've, you know, left it as preserving his legacy. And it's just very sad that, because Tim Cornwell always wanted to be a novelist and had apparently written some novels, or at least one, and not had it published. And I'm sure in a family of novelists, not just having a father who's a super successful novelist, but having other brothers who are...
Was that Tim or was that his brother, Tony?
Tony also went, both Tim and Tony had aspirations of being novelists. And it was really interesting with his brother, too, because he was always open to him, saying he would read his work and stuff. But you can't help, and he even writes one letter where he says, "I know you feel like I'm living your dreams." Again, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not directly quoting, but something like that. But no, yeah, Tim had always wanted to be a novelist. He was a journalist. And I think he achieved that with this book. You know, it's a collection of letters, but it is a narrative for sure, the way that he's assembled them. And he established that from the get-go with this introduction. And he did an absolutely terrific job. So, yeah, it's a tragedy that he didn't live to see its publication and to see its reception. I don't think that someone who wasn't related to him could have done as good a job of this as he did.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a really wonderful collection. And for me, the thing that was amazing was that it was like a biography, really, you know, but through his own work, which I thought was, you know, obviously autobiography is what that is. But I know we got The Pigeon Tunnel and that was sort of that, but not really, right? And I felt like this was much closer to that. It was really a great way to learn about his life. And I thought Tim put the context in there that was really necessary to kind of make it feel like a cohesive work rather than just some sort of random grab bag of whatever letters somebody found kind of interesting.
And I liked how it was organized after that. Like after the early life, it basically falls into being organized by book. Even when there's things that don't relate to that book, it's not like they're all about the book, but that's how his life is divided into those chapters.
Yeah.
And as, you know, as fans of his books, I found that a handy way to do it.
Well, diving into some of the professional things that we learn, there was this one thing that I really liked, this quote. It's not from a letter, but Tim found this quote saying that the reason he wrote about spies the way he did is because he had never took part in a successful operation, which I thought was a really funny little insight into maybe why we saw what we did. Because, you know, the thing about Licari is he was really only operational as a spy for a very short amount of time.
Very short.
And so, you know, he built these this decades-long career as a spy novelist out of what was a relatively small amount of time in the espionage world.
Yeah. Although, in that short time, he did manage to serve in both the major services, which is pretty interesting and gave him some good insight. It sounds like more of his action was in MI5 when he was actually spying on his friends and contemporaries in ways that didn't amount to much. It's clear from the letters. But once he was stationed overseas, we don't know because he was so cagey about it. But it really seems like from things like that, when you say that he didn't ever participate in so successful or in a successful operation, it seems like his MI6 career was less auspicious and obviously curtailed by being betrayed by Blake.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the other things that was great, there's this letter that he writes to John Margetson, and he's talking about how the BBC is adapting Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and his quote is, "Sorry you'll miss it, but I expect it will be lousy." Talking about how he expects this adaption to go. You know, I don't think they'd done any real, they hadn't cast anybody or written it or anything like that. But I think that was just his general feeling about it. And that, you know, I guess for him, hey, plan for the worst and you'll always be surprised, right?
Yeah.
It's funny because later on, he's so gushing about it. No, he writes multiple times to Guinness and all of that, talking about how happy he was with how it worked out, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. His relationship with the film and TV adaptations of his books is one of the stories that's tracked throughout this. And I mean, it seems like he was burnt a lot, you know, and realized early on working a lot on drafts for Small Town in Germany, for Naive and Sentimental Lover, of movies that never happened. By the time that Tinker Tailor came around, I think he had adopted a healthy cynicism to it. I remember, not in this letters book, but in his introduction to the published version of his screenplay for Murder of Quality, he talks about how he swears that he will never write another movie until the next one. You know, like he acknowledges that he keeps swearing it off and then getting involved again. And I found that interesting. I found his relationship with screen adaptations a very interesting aspect of this book that I'm sure we'll get into specifics. But in general, one thing that really interested me was that while literary awards, he completely swore off. You know, he didn't want any part of the literary awards circuit, certainly not in England. He accepted some awards from other countries, but he didn't want to get any UK awards, which is too bad because he certainly deserved them. And I think he would have gotten them if he had accepted things. But while he may have felt that way about books, he put so much weight on Oscars. It's clear throughout this book, like, when he's impressed with it, almost seems to be his barometer for whether these movies are successful or not is what the nominations they get, the Oscar nominations or the BAFTAs for the TV things, or well, both Oscars and BAFTAs. He talks about both of them. And I think Rachel Weisz getting Oscar for The Constant Gardener, it was among like the best accolades that he saw on his career, you know, and Tinker Tailor getting so many BAFTA nominations, the movie, I mean, and I think some wins, I can't remember now, but the way that he writes about them, he does seem to put a lot of stock in movie awards and TV awards, even if he doesn't in book awards, which I thought was interesting, because it seems almost like he's as won over by the glamour, the so-called glamour of the movie industry as anyone else, even though in the literary industry, he's like, been there, done that, and doesn't, you know, he's above it all, but not when it comes to movies and television.
Well, when you start out with your career going to visit Richard Burton and Liz Taylor, you know, to talk them off the ledge, I gotta imagine that kind of skews your sense of reality a little bit there too, right? I mean, which is kind of funny. One of the things that I found interesting reading through this is just, you know, and I knew this before reading this book, but it comes even into clearer focus as you read through some of these letters, is his just inability to take a negative review and let it roll off his back. He is just unable to to handle that.
Yeah.
And there's this one section in particular in the introduction to this letter. It was about Clive James, who apparently was like the number one with a bullet enemy of critical enemy of Le Carre and vice versa. And he wrote in response to the first episode of the Tinker Tailor being released in The Observer, Clive James writes, "The first installment fully lived up to the standards set by the original novel. Though not quite as incomprehensible, it was equally turgid." Ouch. And then Le Carre writes a rather lengthy response where he goes on saying, "It is amusing that Clive James should agonize in public about whether he is conducting a personal vendetta against me, and significant that he does not answer the question." And then he just goes on and on and on, and it's just, he really could not handle somebody going against his work in that manner, right?
Yeah, and I mean, that was clear from the Sisman biography that friendships ended over that. Even when his peers gave him sort of negative feedback on a manuscript he was working, not just published reviews. And there is the story, too, going back to his dogs, that he had trained his whippets to growl at the word critic. Yeah, it's definitely, it's kind of weird that someone so generally well-regarded, you know, in his career was still so thin-skinned about negative reviews. Although, he seemed to be onto something with Clive James. I mean, and he wrote, it was James, right, who he had said he wrote to Guinness warning him in advance that he was going to review it negatively. Was that James?
I don't remember if it was him or not. It wouldn't surprise me.
In one of the letters, he said that he had warned the whole crew on Tinker Tailor that they would get a negative review from this person. I think it was James, and why, and even predicted some of the language that he would use, you know, and did, because he seemed to be wielding an axe against him, grinding an axe against him. Yeah, I would say that one seems legitimate. Probably there were quite a few critics who had it in for him, but I think that made him dismiss all criticism. He would talk about how books were received. Like, he does a couple of times refer to The Naive and Sentimental Lover as being so drummed by critics, but he doesn't ever really own it with that, which was weird because some of his other books he does. He calls Our Game a bum novel, which I was surprised to hear that. I don't think it is at all. I think Our Game is quite a good novel. So I'm not sure how he determined, I mean, this is something you discussed with Steve, you know, how the difference between an author's perception of his work and his audience's perception. I'm not quite sure how he determined that, if he was listening to, you know, if there were certain critics, either professional critics or trusted peers who he listened to, or if it was just his own interpretation. But I was surprised to hear that, whereas he doesn't seem to acknowledge that there might be any problems with Naive and Sentimental Lover there. Usually when he talks about it, it's the critics who were at fault. But it's interesting, we get a letter here that I meant to bookmark and didn't, so I can't quote it, but as a fan of his audiobooks, I was particularly interested in one that reveals why there is no audiobook of The Naive and Sentimental Lover, that apparently he had forbidden that. It wasn't a letter. It was one of the explanatory notes, actually. And apparently twice he forbade it.
Yeah.
I think when Penguin took over was the last time. I don't know. It seems like he did have some feelings that he might have secretly shared the views of a lot of critics that book was not necessarily up to par with some of his others. But there's no letters where he actually acknowledges that, as opposed to that Our Game one, which I just think is odd. That said, he's certainly quick to judge a lot of the TV and movie adaptations of his books himself. That's interesting because that's really not on him. He's now judging other people's work and he can be quite harsh about it. We get a tantalizing thing. This is very interesting in the audiobook that's partly read by Florence Pugh. We get this tantalizing bit about how unhappy he was with the Park Chan-wook TV adaptation of The Little Drummer Girl, which I was really interested in, but we don't get. He says in a letter, but I'll talk more later about that or something, and we don't get the letter that expands on that. I want to know what his problems with that one were. I assume they were not Florence Pugh, because she's reading this audiobook, and by all reports, you know, they had a pretty good relationship. So I wonder what his issues were with that one. But there's other ones, you know, like the movie of The Little Drummer Girl, which is a terrible movie, and which he constantly refers to that one as being a really dispiriting experience with adaptations. But it's interesting too, because he's friends with a lot of these filmmakers, yet he'll still criticize what they've done. Yeah, even if they're derived from his work, he's not shy about critiquing those himself, even if he's braced and armored against Clive James doing so.
Well, Clive James, there's this great opinion piece that he wrote for the New York Times called Wither the Hatchet Job. And I want to read a little bit about it, because it's pretty interesting. And he starts out, ripping somebody's reputation is recognized blood sport. Shredding a new book is a kind of fox hunting that is still legal today. Such critical violence is far less frequent in America. Any even remotely derogatory article in an American journal is called negative, and hardly any American publication wants to be negative. At one stage in my life, I was asked to review a prominent book that I thought needed putting down. It was the late 70s when John le Carré was in the full power of his later phase of production, and the New York Review of Books asked me to write a review of his latest book. I was scarcely a chapter into it before I felt the glue closing over my head. I wrote that Mr. le Carré's style had become verbose and implausible by his own standard, which had been set by his early books, especially by The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, which I called a masterpiece. But no writer wants to hear that he has lapsed from greatness. He wants to hear, at the very least, that his greatness has acquired an extra layer of subtlety, even if it looks like incompetence. In my role as Mr. le Carré's nemesis, I had already experienced what it felt like to be stomped on in print. Years before, John Carey, one of the cleverest of the Oxbridge Dons moonlighting in Grub Street, brought all his wit and knowledge to the task of shriveling my first collection of essays, The Metropolitan Critic. I slept badly for months. Then, several years later, he extolled my book, Unreliable Memoirs, and I felt all the better for having once felt miserable. It was part of the give and take of the British literary world. Mr. le Carré, however, had never really had a bad review in his life until I ambushed him in America. He just wasn't used to it. My review was undoubtedly a hatchet job, and Mr. le Carré was right to be annoyed. For one thing, a negative review in such an influential publication could hardly be good for the book's chances in America, although, in fact, it became a bestseller anyway. Mr. le Carré nonetheless let it be known that he thought I had set out to damage him. I hadn't, but I can see how it might have seemed like that to him. Having far too much fun as I picked out the book's absurdities and pomposities, I had written a British-style killer book review, but I had published it in an American context. And that fact lay the insult and injury. I thought that was interesting because le Carré continually rails against British critics in his, introductions and stuff. And yet you see that the American critics are much kinder to him in his reviews, is what he always says. And so, you know, you get that little kind of back and forth, maybe that it's just a sense of British reviewers are out for blood to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's interesting. But it doesn't stop him from getting into a feud with Tina Brown when she took over the New Yorker later on.
He loved his feuds, right? He loved his professional feuds.
Yep. He also had issues with American critics later in his career once he started writing so many unvarnished critiques of America. And that there was a letter late in the book where he talks about in America, it'll all be, you know, they don't want to hear it. So it's not going to be reviewed well. So at a certain point, he did kind of think that American critics weren't as nice. But yeah, early on, I guess they treated him more kindly than the British press.
Definitely that I found that in his earlier books, for sure, at least through the early 70s.
And the review that Clive James is talking about there was Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, right?
I would assume so. Yeah. Or maybe it was Smiley's People, something like that. I don't know. I didn't look at this specific review he was referring to, but yeah.
Well, I mean, I couldn't disagree with him more on Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, but it's interesting to hear his point of view.
Yeah.
Even authors who do blurbs and stuff or reviews, and there's a lot of letters that kind of like where he's turning down doing a review of someone else's book, and he's very guarded with his blurbs, you know, even writing letters in such a way that you couldn't even like pull a blurb out and use it without his permission, you know. He's very careful with his language, then he has such disdain for some writers who do it a lot. Like Martin Amis, I remember, comes in for some real criticism from him in one of the letters of like, Martin Amis is in the Times again writing something. You know, I can't remember what the review was, but he was really against that.
But there was that great letter, though, that he writes to his like publicity team, right, about this press release, and lays out how they can refer to him as, you know, the greatest spy novelist ever, or, you know, like, right? I mean, that was so funny to read, right?
Yeah. Another big bugaboo for him was being told that his career was over because the Cold War ended. He hated that. There was, I think, one when I think this was when Sonny Mehta had taken over Knopf, and there was a blurb that was going to call him the like master of the Cold War espionage novel, right, or something like that. And he hated that. There was a long letter about that, how one hates to see one's tomb inscribed, you know, in like, so no, you can say these other things, but don't equate me to the Cold War. And then there was another critic who he wrote, it wasn't even a critic. It was just, I think, a fan who had written to him something about, and just sort of innocuously mentioned something about the end of the Cold War. Oh, no, it was the cartoonist. Sorry, that was actually a great letter from Jeff Danziger, American political cartoonist, who had done a cartoon that was, I mean, it felt innocuous to me, where it was when one of the American spies was rooted out. I think it was maybe when Aldrich Ames was arrested, and it had, like a caricature of Le Carré thanking God for that. And Le Carré wrote him a letter that was both nice and kind of affronted, where he he praises his cartooning and he thanks him for a flattering likeness, and then he says, one hates to see the epithet written for one's career when he's at the height of his game, or something like that. And he gives him a list of acclaimed books that he's done that have nothing to do with the Cold War, which was just clearly he'd struck a nerve.
Le Carré had no problem being a little bitchy when it came to certain things, right?
Prickly.
The other interesting one was when he's, you know, talking, because you have Philip Roth, who wrote that, you know, blurb that has since then stayed on A Perfect Spy, right? Yeah. What is it? The best British novel of the post-war era, right? And he writes kind of a letter of appreciation to Philip Roth after that. And it felt funny how, I'm sure it wasn't the only time, but it was one of the few times you see him dropping an F-bomb in a letter.
There were a couple.
Somehow to Roth, that seems very appropriate that's the one that he's going to do it with.
I mean, there were certainly some, like when he gets really angry later on in the Trump era, I think there were a few. But it's interesting the relationship that he has with the writers, the other writers who praise him. Like I say, he didn't like Martin Amis, although I don't remember if Martin Amis had specifically attacked him. Some writers attacked him over his, really, I'd say, history has proven him wrong on the side that he was on with Salman Rushdie. But yeah, some other British writers attacked him over that feud with Rushdie. And that was a weird position to take, basically, that he shouldn't have published the Satanic Verses if he knew it was going to cause violence. Just an odd position for a writer to take. I see where, you know, morally it's an interesting, you know, a defendable position for sure. But for an artist or a writer to, you know, suggest that one shouldn't make art because it might provoke a certain response seems odd. And he did get a lot of flack from other British writers about that. And yeah, he didn't seem to take it too well when he did. But the writers who praised him, though, he was also very praiseful of, Philip Roth being one of them. And one wonders, you know, if like his relationship with Tom Stoppard would have continued as well if Stoppard had ever given him a real negative reaction to one of the books that he read in galleys, because he was one of his trusted writers, and it sounds like he did take notes from him, which I was kind of surprised by, because from other things that he said, I thought he wouldn't take notes from anyone. But I would love to see the reverse of that letter, where he's talking about the notes that Stoppard gave him on one book. I forget which book it was, but one of his more recent ones, I think. But yet he had ended a relationship with someone before for giving him very mild negative feedback about Naive and Sentimental Lover. This was in Sisman, and it was of the constructive criticism variety. So yeah, I'm not sure, you know, maybe he got slightly thicker skin later on, but he does seem, if he really respects a writer, to take some constructive criticism from him, but I suspect it has to be worded very carefully, you know, when you're giving him any feedback like that.
Yeah, no bullet points of all the things that you think you need to fix. Yeah, I don't think that would have gone over very well.
Yeah.
I did like a lot of the insights we got on, you know, that kind of writer to publisher relationship. There's some insights on cover illustrations and some back and forth on that, which he, you know, you can see that he actually took a lot of interest in how his books were shown, as far as like the illustrations and how they were made and all of that, which I thought was really kind of interesting to see. I mean, obviously, I'm sure most authors are really curious about that, but I guess he was in a position where he actually had a little bit of juice to make some changes if necessary, right?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. Where we get the most insight, I think, is in the Sonny Mehta era at Knopf. And it's the Night Manager and Our Game, maybe the Constant Gardener, that we get a lot of these letters about the covers. And one interesting thing that he says about the Night Manager is that he doesn't like guns on his covers, which I thought was really interesting, because when we're talking about the spy genre and iconography of it, you know, that's certainly one of the kind of icons of the spy genre and on a lot of covers. And you know, obviously he's always positioned himself as sort of the anti-Fleming, but clearly that's a big part of James Bond cover imagery. Yet he's not dead against it for the Night Manager, because he does want kind of a Bond cover, it sounds like, that, because he wants it to show the glamour. He suggests a Rolls Royce being on it. He wants audiences to see kind of the glamour world that Roper lives in. And yeah, that one he was against a gun being on the cover, but he was open to it. But yeah, that was kind of interesting, the genre that we're dealing in, to hear that he didn't want that. And it made me think of the poster for the movie of The Constant Gardener, which we know he loved. And that poster showed Ralph Fiennes with a gun, which was really interesting, because it's not a movie that has a lot of guns. It's one scene in the movie where he ends up holding this gun. And I don't think that even happens in the book, if I recall correctly. But it became the imagery for selling the movie. And I doubt he had the say-so over the movie imagery as he did over the book, although he did write to John Callie at Sony, since they were friends, although that friendship cooled after the way that the Tailor of Panama was kind of dumped in England, apparently, the movie. But he did have a letter to him about the poster for that movie, which was interesting. And I love the poster for that movie. It was a great poster. So it sounds from the letter like this poster partly came about because of Le Carré's advocacy, which is interesting. It was one of the last painted movie posters. I think it was Czerny. I can't remember for sure who the artist was. But it's a great painted poster. It used to hang over my bed in the early, when I first moved to LA. I don't know where it's gone now, but it's really a wonderful poster, and it seems like he was advocating that poster, although I could be wrong. Maybe he was against it, but it sounded like that was the one he wanted. But that's a tangent. Sorry, I was talking about cover art. The one we get the most on is Our Game, but again, this is mainly correspondence with his American publisher, which is interesting, because Our Game, collectors will be familiar with, is kind of famous for having a British cover that he hated, that it went out with originally, and was quickly recalled. And so the first edition has two states. One state has the bad cover that he didn't like, which is sort of, it's basically, actually, we're doing this on Squadcast, I think, one of these programs, and I see a little icon in the bottom right of the screen of two silhouettes, like one in front of the other, and that's sort of the cover of the version he didn't like of Our Game. And yeah, obviously it's prized by collectors because it was the first one and it's rarer, but he put a stop to it, and he had, you know, basically got out on export versions, and he had another cover put on that I guess he must have liked better. I think the other cover isn't very good either, but I'm sure there was a battle behind that, and I would have loved to see the letters of, you know, that story. But instead we get the ones about the American one, which, you know, didn't have any last minute drama like that. It had some back and forth about the size of a watchtower. And that book actually has a third cover, because that was the era when the Canadian publishers were doing their own thing too. And I think the Canadian cover is the best of Our Game, which also has the watchtower imagery. And it would be really interesting to have seen if there were also letters about the UK and Canadian covers, because there must have been, but we only are privy in the book, unfortunately, to the letters about the US cover.
Well, he advocated for a Rolls-Royce, but I'm sure that Rolls-Royce would have been a rental from Avis, yeah. Right? Because we get this other letter that is just, it's just one of those fun ones, you know? Like, there's some that are, like, very dramatic and, you know, angsty kind of, like, personal stuff, but this one was just a fun letter from a fan, right?
Yeah, I loved that one. It was a fan who happened to be the president of Avis, right?
Yes.
Who was thanking him for showing, was it Pine who had rented from Avis? Which character of his was it?
I forget who it was, but yes, he has one of the characters renting a car from Avis Car Rentals.
And he says, in the future, basically this guy, by writing as a praiseful fan, got a response of free product placement. it's very tongue-in-cheek, like you say. But he says, in the future, my characters will continue to rent Avis cars, unless they're baddies, in which case they'll be sure to rent from Enterprise or one of the others.
Hertz, I think he said, yes.
But what was funny was, yes, later on, much later, there's a letter about how he and Jane had traveled to Ireland and had trouble getting a rental car because of their ages. Like, they were both older than the limit,
right,
at
yeah.
that time of their, that was, you know, in the last years of his life. And I just wondered, why didn't he call his friend at Avis? You know, I'm sure he could have hooked him up with a car.
Yeah, I really liked that one. I thought that was really fun. But, you know, to jump back to some of his publishing drama, he's got that letter to Bob Gottlieb declining his services because, like, he'd had him as an editor, and then Gottlieb, I guess, kind of retired or stepped back, and then he came back again to edit. There's this great thing even before that letter, though, where there's this throwaway aside where Gottlieb had been quoted saying about The Secret Pilgrim that it was the weakest of all his novels and could think of nothing I might have suggested to salvage it, which is rather harsh.
Yeah, but the footnote notes there that it's the only one that he didn't edit of that era, you know,
yeah,
which is interesting. So, you know, it's a rather self-serving remark to make. But their relationship began on The Naive and Sentimental Lover. So that's particularly interesting, which you have to admire, not for taking a gamble, you know, on that was the book that they began their very long-term relationship with this author on, where he's going out of his genre, you know, like he's had such success in one genre alone and then decides to change publishers at the unsafest moment. And they take him on that. And it didn't do well for them. You know, that book was not a commercial success, but then it shows Gottlieb's, you know, real smarts in making that deal, because then he got Tinker Tailor next. And obviously those three books did really well for them, as did, you know, most of the books that he did for them. So, yeah, that's interesting that someone who started his working relationship with Le Carre on that book would then say that the Secret Pilgrim was the worst, which, you know.
Although I did like that there's the quote from Le Carre where he says he was working on Smiley's speech to the passing out class of Surratt, and it ran away from me and became a novel. Which I think does kind of give you the sense that the Secret Pilgrim was kind of a bit of a lark more than anything, than a fully fleshed out novel, which I think everybody could kind of agree on. I don't know. You tell me if I've off the mark there.
Well, and it sounds like, I mean, I've always seen The Night Manager as growing out of one of the stories in The Secret Pilgrim. The final story in that, which even has Burr as the sort of antagonist of this arms dealer. It's a proto Roper character. It seems like almost a draft version of The Night Manager. So yeah, I think that book in some ways was just sketches, but it's weird that later on he writes about this new novel that never happened because he died when he was working on it, that it was going to be a collection of interconnected short stories about Smiley's life, narrated by Gwillem, which, oh man, I would have loved to see. You know, I hope he had a lot of it done. I'm sure, as you and Steve discussed, that we will see a version of it. I just don't know how much of it will actually be him and how much will be Nick Harkaway building on his plans. I would have loved to have seen Le Carre live to publish that, because it sounds amazing. But what his eureka moment is when he hits on doing this series of interconnected Smiley stories throughout his career, narrated by Gwillem. And that it's weird that the letter seems like such a eureka moment, because that's essentially the Secret Pilgrim. The difference is it's not Gwillym, which to me was the big flaw of the Secret Pilgrim. I wanted more Gwillym. We only get one very, very brief mention of Gwillym, and it's not a flattering one. Instead, it's narrated by Ned, who was a character introduced in his previous book, The Russia House. Yeah, I wonder if that, you know, one, I wonder why it didn't occur to him at the time to have Gwillym as the narrator, which just seems like the logical, because he'd written an introduction to a Sherlock Holmes collection where he talks about Gwillym as the Watson to Smiley's Holmes back in the early 90s. So, you know, you'd think that that would be the first thing to occur to him. But later on, that was the moment that got him really into this book that he was working on now. So they're both interconnected stories throughout Smiley's career, but this one was going to be narrated by Gwillym. So is that the difference? It's interesting to speculate, but yeah, we may never know for sure.
Well, you know, of all the professional revelations here, you know, we hear about his promotion a lot about how, you know, it just is this time suck of promoting his new books that are coming out and all of that. But, you know, one of the biggest revelations I thought that was related to that was the fact that we missed out on John le Carré on Desert Island Discs.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure, you know, all of the British listeners are ruining the day that didn't come to fruition, right?
Well, and the reason why, that he's tone deaf, which is an interesting thing to learn about him, because there aren't a lot of mentions of music in his books. And the list that we get of what he might have talked about on Desert Island Discs is more like, oh, because his neighbor
neighbor, what a snore list. God, it was a good choice. They're probably like, we dodged a bullet there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It seems like he really probably didn't listen to music too much, other than, you know, he says that sometimes he would go and appreciate it with Jane if he could follow the beat or something, you know, find something to latch onto, but that he was tone deaf. And another choice on his list was going to be the Elgar. Is it Elgar? The classical piece that begins the Tinker Tailor adaptation, which, you know, yeah, of course he likes that. it's true. He might not have been the best guest, but sure wish that show had happened and existed, because, you know, it would have been nice. But his main reason against it is that he wouldn't have wanted to answer the same questions that he answered to every member of the press about what do you write about now that the Cold War is over and stuff. It's definitely a grumpy kind of letter. So yeah, the one piece that he was going to include was Jeffrey Bergen's classical piece that was used as the title music for the BBC Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Yeah. Well, what other professional things that did you want to make sure we touched on?
Well, you know, as someone involved in the movie business, I was fascinated with all the movie things, and particularly with how often he was a screenwriter. I mean, not just even for adaptations. Like there was a downhill skiing movie that he wrote for his son, the producer, Stephen Cornwell, which, and this was long before the Ink Factory started, when he was first starting as a producer, I guess I think it was the late 80s or early 90s that he wrote this script based on le Carré's own experience as a downhill skier in Switzerland in the 1950s, which, wow, I really want to read that script. If the heirs to le Carré do keep publishing Unseen Material, that would seem to me like a good candidate. You know, put out that script, put out some other scripts that he wrote. Otherwise, you know, one day I'll have to make a trip to the Bodleian Library and read these things. I would love to read his apparently non-spy story about the world of competitive downhill skiing in the 1950s. I think it was, you know, based on his time, because he says later on in another letter, talks about how the sport is terrible today. You know, it was great back in my day.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would love to see his at the Endgame produced as well, printed out, because we haven't seen that published as well.
Right. That's published in German, but not in English, yeah. Which is so frustrating. Yeah. End Station. And it was also...
End Station. Yes, thank you.
Yeah. And the British teleplay, the actual play that was filmed for TV for Armchair Theater, I don't know if it exists. I think it exists. I don't think it's wiped, but it's never been released. It's not available to see.
Right.
Whereas the German one, it was then remade in Germany for German television. That's on DVD. I think it's on YouTube as well. You can see the German one easily, but not with subtitles, of course. And yeah, you can buy the script of it as a published Le Carré book in Germany, but not in English-speaking countries, which is crazy. But so many other scripts. I mean, he talks about the various drafts he did of Small Town in Germany, which I'd be very interested to see. And that was the first of his collaborations with Sidney Pollack, who he then worked for a long time with on The Night Manager and got very frustrated with. And that's a relationship we do see kind of deteriorate in the letters. He was friendly with him for a while and then seems to have become bitter over the fact that Pollack apparently, well, the way he puts it in his letter, clearly you knew a long time ago you weren't going to actually make this movie. I think we both have to acknowledge that now. I get the feeling from the letters that The Night Manager is one of his favorites, and he seems to have really wanted to see it filmed.
Which is funny, right? Because it's such a different type of book for him, right?
Yeah.
It's so much more, kind of leans to that commercial glossy end of things, right?
Yeah, and it's also, I've always seen it as a sort of counterpoint to The Honorable Schoolboy, because they're both stories about an undercover man going into a situation where there's a battle between enforcement and intelligence. And in The Honorable Schoolboy, Smiley is the hero character who wants the intelligence. And it's ultimately the American DEA who screws up everything. You know, they've been making their inroads through Sam Collins, and Smiley's been oblivious to it. And they get their enforcement way in the end. And instead, they go in to arrest the guy that Drake Coe's brother, who Smiley wants to turn. You know, he could use him as a great intelligence weapon against Carla. And they just want to go in for an American police arrest. Le Carre himself seems to have changed his mind on the subject by the early 90s, because in The Night Manager, Burr is the character who wants enforcement. He wants to end Roper's career, whereas now the American-influenced British intelligence creep, whose name I think is Dark, you know, it's very symbolic, he wants to keep using him as an intelligence asset and let him stay in play, making his dirty money off of these arms sales that are leading to deaths of people. I guess the moral side has changed from the 70s to the 90s, or at least Le Carre's position on the compass has changed. But yeah, it's interesting that it's a refutal almost, or a rebuttal to the Honorable Schoolboy. It's like now he's on the side of enforcement and the side of intelligence is in the wrong. So another interesting reason that it would be a favorite of his, since it seems to be an about face from what he's earlier written. Anyway, yeah, there were a lot of scripts for that, including one with Brad Pitt attached, which, you know, I remember when that was reported, and it always seemed weird to me, although I think there's a letter where Le Carre is happy about it, because, I mean, of course, Brad Pitt's going to get something made, but I can't see him as Pine. I don't think that would have been the right direction for that script.
Well, he also talks about Daniel Day-Lewis and Julia Roberts being in his mind when he is writing the
Oh, right.
The novel, too. So
Yeah, his dream casting.
He obviously saw it as a very cinematic kind of a novel for him.
Yeah.
More so than probably some of his others.
He has a few letters that talk about dream casts for him. And it's interesting to see him like fantasizing about who he wants. And, you know, the one case where he got his dream cast was Alec Guinness, where he writes this very, very sucking up to him letter, you know, like, he's praising Guinness of how great he is and how he always had him in mind. And it's just laying the groundwork. This is like before there's even a script written, but he's like, would you be willing to let them send you the script when it's written? And, you know, it worked. You know, I think it's clear that Guinness was also a man who was responded to flattery, as Le Carre seems to have. You know, he liked the letters that praised him and reviews that praised him. And in this case, it was the right... You know, absolutely the right thing. That's the perfect combination. And there's also just a fantastic picture of the two of them on Hampstead Heath in the book. It's just a candid of Guinness is in his Smiley costume, but talking to Le Carre, man, I would love a blow up of that as a poster. Like, it's just such a very cool image for any fans of the show or those books. But yeah, I find his whole relationship with the movie and television industry fascinating throughout, whether it's kind of sucking up to people in hopes of getting the ideal cast, or critiquing what's been made, or just getting excited about awards. But most of all, when he's writing scripts, because yeah, there's so many drafts that he has apparently written over the years. And the only one that was ever published in English was Murder of Quality. And I would love to see some of his other scripts published.
Well, anything else professional-wise that you wanted to make sure we didn't forget to talk about?
Well, you and Steve talked about it, but I did love getting sort of the answer to what you and I had speculated about on an earlier episode of this podcast about Silverview. What was the reason that he scrapped it? And although I have a kind of different take from what Steve had, yes, it's true that Le Carre's given reason in his letter to Tom Stoppard is that he didn't have anything new to say, that it was revisiting old themes that he'd already been over. I think that's true, but I think that that's almost what we said, what we came to in our speculation, and it just made it a perfect posthumous book. You know, the very thing that might have sunk it as a book at that point in his career, and maybe Le Carre realized this, and this is why he left it in the desk and left the decision of whether to publish or not up to his sons. I think it came out at the time it was supposed to come out, ultimately, because as a posthumous extra gift, it was great because it hits all those themes that we'd already love about Le Carre. So yes, I can see it as being, to me, it's a very credible reason. I mean, again, Steve pointed out he's not the most reliable narrator in all cases, and I could see him giving a different reason to another person, but this one feels credible to me because it's absolutely true. It's not dealing in new themes, but it is really a concise revisiting of all of his favorite themes that worked wonderfully as a posthumous novel and really just made it a gift to us after that. So, but it was great to get an answer of some sort.
All right, well, we're going to stop here, but we will return for part 3 of 3 of this series looking at his novels. I'll have links to the various things we talked about today in the show notes and the episode page at lecarrecast.com. If you enjoyed the show, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. You can always feel free to drop us a comment on the website or at Twitter at lecarrecast. Thank you, Matthew, for joining me today, and we will be back next time for our final episode in this series. Until next time, thanks for listening. Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.